I couldn't then afford to rent the farmhouse on my own, so I moved onto the land and lived in a caravan we happened to have there. And I was very happy there and lived off-grid for probably about 10 years.
Welcome to Curious Chats and Kind Acts, the podcast that celebrates difference, kindness, and the little things we can all do to make our world a better place. Join me, your host, Sonia, co-founder of the X Charity, for some open, authentic, and fun conversations with lots of interesting, extraordinary, everyday people who are all a little bit different. Prepare to have your curiosity piqued and your heart warmed as we explore the ways we can all make a difference in the world, no matter how small. So get ready to be inspired, uplifted, and motivated to be the kindest version of yourself. Let's make the world a kinder place, one conversation at a time. Alrighty then, how are you today? Welcome to Curious Chats and Kind Acts. In this episode, I speak to Kathy. Kathy's a retired social worker with a fascinating life. We hear about her journey that saw her living in a caravan in the middle of a field for 10 years. It includes homelessness, teenage pregnancy, adultery, bigamy. There's a lot to unpack. Then we hear about what it's like living in a field without running water whilst trying to rear pigs who like to wallow in water. We chat about carbon monoxide poisoning and medicinal spliffs. There's lots of twists and turns in this one, and I hope you enjoy hearing about it as much as I did. I start off by asking Kathy where it all began for her.
I was born in Liverpool and we moved to Ellesmere Port when I was very young, less than two, because my dad worked at Stanlow, the oil refinery in Ellesmere Port. And I was very happy there with my two brothers and my parents until my parents moved us to Chester when I was 10 or 11. And then I became a very rebellious child because they'd moved me from my happy place. I was a terribly behaved teenager, but it didn't seem to hold me back in life. I'd had children, two children, and got myself married by the time I was 20.
Blimey, when would you have your youngest child then?
I was 18 when I had my first child, so I was 17, homeless and pregnant for a while. But that's life, isn't it?
You were homeless at 17?
Yeah, my parents threw me out because I was pregnant. So, yeah, I was 17, homeless and pregnant. But that was okay. I lived in a hostel in Lawn Street for unmarried mums.
And how did you hear about that, though?
Oh, a social worker came to the hospital and took me there after I'd given birth.
Where were you before you gave birth if you were homeless?
I was sofa surfing in the latter stages of my pregnancy.
Blimey.
That was how it was. It's
a very good attitude to have. Yeah. Did you feel like that at the time?
Well, it was what it was. You just have to cope, don't you, and get on.
And did you think at any point, I can't keep this baby, or was that just not...
Oh, no. There was a lot of people telling me I couldn't keep this baby. But, you know, I was like, don't be daft, it's mine.
Yeah.
You know, so...
And was the birth creator still around?
Yeah. We went on to have another child and we eventually got married. But he had bipolar, so he wasn't easy to live with. And that was after we'd had our third child. We separated when the third child was two because I couldn't cope with him, his mood swings and what have you. And then I was quite happy as a single parent. And then I studied to be a social worker because I worked in the community running place schemes and what have you for the Blaken Project because I lived in Blaken.
Okay.
And they encouraged me to do more. And I did some A-levels in me. Spare time, I did psychology, sociology and politics.
Because you'd have left school without qualification.
Well, I left school with O-levels, as they were in those days, but not A-levels. But I'd gone to catering college and done a City and Guilds in catering, so at least I could feed myself.
Yeah. So you're a single parent with three kids. How was life then?
It was okay. The husband used to get drunk and turn up a lot. And so after I'd qualified as a social worker and there was a jobs freeze on in this area, I took the opportunity to move to Staffordshire with the kids, and that stopped him turning up at the door. And I worked for Staffordshire for 3 years. And then the kids wanted to move back to Chester, really. So I got a job with Flintshire in 1995, I think it was. And then we got a council house in Blaken. And moved back. And then I met Dave about 8 years later. and married him.
How did you meet him?
He taught trade union studies and I was on a course with Unison, so I met him on a course.
That's romantic.
That was quite romantic.
He got off of your teacher.
Yeah. Not at the course, you know, we exchanged pleasantries at the course, but when he was back teaching in Mould again, he'd said to a colleague of mine, "Oh, I was hoping that Kathy would be on this course today." So she's like, "Wow, she's a good friend of mine, and I've got her phone number." So
did he ring you up?
Well, yeah.
It was back in the day before the texting.
Oh, it was back in the day before mobile phones.
I've forgotten what it's like to court. So did he like ring you on the house phone?
Yeah. Yeah, we used to have conversations on the house phone each night, you know, as we were getting to know each other.
And did he get on all right with the kids and stuff?
The oldest two had left home by then. So there's only Dan, who was about 9 or 10 when we started seeing each other. And they got on relatively well. But Dan had his own relationship with his dad, so he wasn't too bothered, you know.
So you...
Turns out he was an arsehole as well.
Okay, carry on.
He's dead now, so we can speak ill of him.
You can speak ill of the dad in this instance.
We got married in 2000 and bought a house, which was all very grown up. And then just 3 years later, he had an affair.
How did you find out about the affair?
Well, he wasn't very good at covering his tracks. He'd come home late one night and I thought he'd gone straight to the door and I thought I'd be kind and make him a joint, and I didn't have any baccy, so I went to get a cigarette out of his coat pocket and pulled out a packet of condoms which we didn't use. So
what did you say to him? Did it an instant thing or did you take it?
Nothing I could repeat on tape. But I kicked the shit out of him and threw him out of my house, basically, is what I did.
But you'd still gave it a go after that?
Yeah, we were separated for the best part of a year and we went to couples counselling, you know, so I was quite committed to this relationship, you know. So we did get back together, but I could never trust him again. And then when the youngest child turned 21, we buggered off. We went and lived in Somerset. I felt a dummy bit.
Yeah, why Somerset? It's quite a...
Well, we bought a piece of land. We were scouring the country for a nice plot of land for sale and we found some in Somerset.
Oh, so you literally went and lived off the land and... Mm. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. Yeah, we applied for planning permission to run a small campsite in a small holding and we didn't get it. So that was a bitter blow for us and we ended up renting a small farmhouse. And then he... Inevitably, because a leopard doesn't change its spots, had another affair. And this time I thought, there's no coming back from it this time.
Yeah.
Off you go, matey. I couldn't then afford to rent the farmhouse on my own, so I moved on to the land and lived in a caravan we happened to have there. And I was very happy there and lived off-grid for probably about 10 years.
Well, so you, like no electricity?
No, I had some solar panels. I had a gas fridge, I had no running water, no mains power.
So how did you get your water? Is there a well or something?
No, I had a neighbouring small holder about a quarter of a mile away who let me use his outside tap, and I had half a dozen of those caravan barrels, aqua rolls they're called, and I used to put them in a trailer and in the back of the car and fill them all up and drive them back. And I could drive around my field with these barrels because I kept pigs. You know?
Right.
It's a ridiculous thing to do is keep pigs when you live off-grid. Don't ever do that.
So what's the issue with pigs? They need a lot
they
of water.
They need a lot of water. They need a wallow. They need to be able to wallow in mud to protect their skin.
How many barrels a day did you have to fill?
Oh, a lot.
Really?
And I used to keep a record of how many barrels I filled up. But Ben never took any money from me. I used to pay him in eggs.
Okay.
Because I kept chickens as well.
Yeah. Like trading. The old-fashioned way, isn't it? You can have my water for half a dozen eggs per barrel.
Yeah, that was kind of basically it. But that was what it was like down there. It's very rural. It's a very different life to city life.
I assume you spent a lot of time on your own down there.
Yeah. I had dogs and pigs and chickens, so I was never completely alone.
And did you feel lonely or were you quite content in your own company?
No, I am very content in my own company. It gives you time and space to think and learn new skills, and not having a bloke that you had to clean up after was quite a relief, actually.
So you did that for 10 years?
I did that until my health got too poor. And I had to come up here a couple of times after surgeries to recover. And eventually the family intervened, so to speak.
So when you say your health declined, was that as a consequence of living off-grid or...?
I'm not sure altogether. I've got COPD as a result of carbon monoxide poisoning, and that was my own stupid fault because me and a traveller put the wood burner in ourselves.
You and a traveller?
Yeah, I had a traveller living on my field over the winter, Simon the Pirate.
And, wait there, how did you meet Simon the Pirate?
On Plenty of Fish. He lived in a scrapyard further down the road, actually, and I had met him before when I went to get some water butts from there.
And then you met on, is that a dating site?
Yeah.
Plenty of Fish.
But we just became friends. And then he was working part-time in a scrapyard at the end of the lane from where my land was. And he asked if he could spend the winter there because he needed to do some work on his truck and get to work at the scrapyard. And I said, yeah, no problem. He was good friends. He passed away in January this year, sadly.
So Simon the Pirate helped you put a log stove in?
Well, I had a wood burner that I'd bought off some friends in Glastonbury that they'd bought off a bloke who'd made it out of an old gas canister. And then they'd found it wouldn't comply with building regulations, so they hadn't had it fitted in their house. So I bought it off them. So I had that sitting in the caravan, waiting to be connected. So basically, we made a hole in the wall of the caravan to put the pipe out through and up. But what the problem was that we were burning pine all winter that we were getting really cheap from the sawmill. And it's really pitchy and sticky pine, isn't it? It leaves a residue inside your chimney that other ash sticks to. And over time, the aperture closes. And so carbon dioxide, monoxide, is released into your caravan instead of up the chimney. So slowly but surely, it was killing me. And when the alarm went off, I didn't know what it was. Yeah. I'm poking at my phone and pushing at my alarm clock and what have you. And I eventually realised it was carbon monoxide alarm, so I took the batteries out and opened the windows and went back to bed. But luckily, neither the dog or I woke up dead, but it did give me lung disease.
Blimey. And you talked about, like, you bought cheap wood. How did you get money? Like, you can't... Only so many eggs and you're giving them for water.
Well, I worked part-time as a social worker for Somerset County Council.
Okay.
So there's my acceptable face of civilised person and then off-grid hippie who was mates with travellers. So, yeah, management didn't like me because of that. You know, I didn't quite fit their mould.
But that's really interesting. So it's almost like you've got the you, probably, I'm guessing, the authentic you of in your caravan living off-grid. And then you'd, I don't know, put a suit on or whatever and go off, put a face on.
I didn't wear a suit unless I was in court.
So you'd go out and do a professional job and act not like you, would you say? Did you have to put a face on, a front on, or do you still felt you could be your authentic self?
I think I was still my authentic self. You know, I didn't smoke weed during the working hours, but apart from that, yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's really good. Because, you know, we've talked to people who are very much... I've got my work face and never the two shall meet kind of thing.
I drove around in a van with flowers stuck all over it and I wore kind of hippie kind of clothes.
Excellent. Which is great. And it's like, don't we want more of that in society?
Well, I was working with foster carers and looked after children and I think it was just easier for children to communicate with somebody who isn't a suit. You know, who looks approachable, who will sit and colour with them.
Like, were there ever times where you had no money?
Well, I've got chickens, so there was always eggs.
Always eggs. Just lived off eggs.
No, there was a time when I was living on £300 a month, a very small amount of money. But as I was off grid, it was okay. I didn't have the bills and the rent, you know.
So we're divorced from... Husband number two?
Yeah, he buggered off, as I say. I threw him out and then I didn't hear from him for a good while until he phoned up out of the blue. The year I was having my knee replaced, I'd just had my knee replaced, and he phoned and asked for a divorce. And by this point, we'd been separated for 4.5 years. And I said to him, you can wait another 6 months and then you can divorce me without my permission. Why not wait? And instead, he tried to divorce me on the grounds of unreasonable behaviour. By me, cheek. And so I gave my opinion to the court in the papers that I sent back. And then we never heard again about the divorce. And he subsequently went on to marry again anyway. Now, this is silly because he worked in the same small trade union world as my best mate.
Yeah.
So how he thought I wouldn't get to hear about this.
Yeah.
Or maybe he thought I wouldn't care. But I went to the police and had him done for bigamy.
Did you?
I did. He was fined £1,000, which didn't come to me.
So is that all that happens if you... no prison sentence?
Oh, no, you can't. It depends, really. If you enter into a bigamous marriage in order to profit from it.
Right. He was just a bit lazy.
He was just a bit stupid.
Yeah.
You know. He was just fined. But it is still classed as a domestic abuse.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, yeah. But I didn't get any compensation for it. And then the bugger dropped dead in May this year while he was on Coronation Day, while he was out with his fake wife. Yeah, we would have had to get divorced for him to marry her, but we didn't.
Do you know her or of her? Or?
We've been in contact since. She'd gone into his workplace and said she thought that she needed to speak to me. So I said, yeah, fine.
How did that go?
Yeah, fine. She wanted to know if we were divorced. And she wanted to unpick some of the lies that had been telling her.
So we've dealt with the idiot ex number two, and we're now back in...
Yeah, I had a lot of arthritis. I had a knee replaced, and then I had to have my right hand repaired. And then while I was recovering from that, I had a detached retina, so more recovery time. And I did have to come up here and stay with my daughter. And so I'd rented my field out.
Right, okay.
Because I realised I wasn't going to be able to cope.
So, and then you've transitioned back here now and you live here full time. And
I
you've
do.
Got a flat. And how's that, living back in a flat?
It's been odd, but I mean, it's a flat with a yard, so I'm still able to grow my own food. I am contemplating a couple of chickens, but at the moment I've got a little foster dog, long-term foster dog, who, when we lived on the land, did kill three of the chickens during the time she was there.
I don't know what my dog would do if I let him loose with chickens. He'd be scared. What dog is it?
She's a French bulldog.
Oh, okay. So they're...
So she wasn't big enough to kill and eat them, you know. She killed them, I ate them. It was fine.
No waste.
Well, no, because I'd had a little Shih Tzu who lived with me because absolutely nobody else would have him. He was four when he came to me and he absolutely loved that field. But he was brilliant at catching rabbits and pheasants. And so we'd share. Yeah. If I could get the pheasant off him long enough to get the breast meat off, I'd give him the rest back.
And I assume you're happy skinning an animal then?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, blimey, such a different world.
Kill it, cook it, eat it, that's me. Well, I did cook a lot outdoors, actually, in the summer because a couple of travellers had built me this fabulous brick barbecue.
So is it almost like you've got a community of travellers that had come and stay on your land? And
well, I had Simon the Pirate there and then his mate Strawberry came for a while. His real name was Rory, but we called him Strawberry. So he came for a while as well. So things got done when the pair of them were there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was... Like, because again, that's a very different lifestyle because they're moving around as well. Did you learn lots from them? And was that an exciting kind of...
Yeah, I had a lot of contact with people who travelled and people who lived off-grid. Like the chap who built my solar system? He'd lived off-grid since 1979, so he knew his stuff. He also ran a festival. Yeah, he runs a part of Glastonbury Festival, which has been entirely run by solar for over 30 years. Wow. You know, he's quite a pioneer.
Yeah.
He lived in a village, above the village, in a caravan with a little building off it that had been built out of doors and grew his own vegetables and whatever. And he was a really, really lovely chap. And he came down, he built this for me, you know, in exchange. I paid him for his time and all the bits and also gave him a tin bath. which had been, I can't even remember how it ended up on my field, but he said, are you using that? And I said, well, I've grown potatoes in it. And he said, well, I could use that to make a hot tub out of, an outdoor hot tub.
Wow.
Crack on then. I said, you take that.
That's brilliant. And would you say, like, by having those really fun and interesting connections, it's actually broadened your thinking and your way that you want to live, like you're learning off each other? And
I think so. I think it also shapes how I live in the city as well. You know, I'm frugal and I live very lightly. You know, I don't have electronic gadgetry in my home. I haven't even got a telly. Do you know what I mean? I don't have a telly. I don't have a computer. My electric costs £30 a month. So I've just had to pay £17 actually in electricity, and it's the first I've had to pay for a year since the government started giving us £67 a month towards our fuel bills. Well, £67 a month covered my gas and electric.
Wow, that's incredible. That's living frugally.
Yeah.
And that's a choice, isn't it, that you're making...
It is a choice.
...sacrifices.
I don't think I am making sacrifices. I think people have expectations about turning taps and water coming out and switching switches and light coming on, because that's the way it is in the city. If you've lived off grid, in order for water to come out your tap, you've got to go and get it.
Yeah, you use less.
In order for a light to come on, you switch it, you've got to get make sure your solar system's set up properly, you know.
Just makes you appreciate.
Yeah. So you think, well, do I really need to be wasting power? And the other thing about wasting power is not just the impact it has on the planet, but also the amount of profit that those obscene companies are making. I am not prepared to give them a penny more than I have to.
Yeah.
So I will sit with a dressing gown on and a hot water bottle in my pocket rather than pay them bookers.
Blimey, so you will sit cold with a hot water bottle.
I won't be cold, but I won't put the heating on unless it's necessary. Yeah. But I dress for the weather because I used to have to get up and go out and feed the pigs in all weathers, you know. So you know how to dress in layers and thermals and gloves and things.
Yeah.
It's just what you do.
And so we're pretty much up to date now, aren't we? You've moved back but are living frugally. Seeing your family more, I assume.
I spend a lot of time now with the family, and that's been lovely.
Yeah.
That's been my saving grace, really, because I thought it might break me having to leave that lifestyle. I loved living off-grid.
Yeah.
And if my health hadn't failed, I never would have left my caravan. I'd have died in that field quite happily, you know. But, yeah, I've got a lot of grandchildren who I didn't have when I moved out to Somerset.
Yeah.
I've got 4 grandchildren, and I love to spend time with them all.
And are you pretty healthy now, are you?
I am riddled with arthritis, but I've now had 1 knee and 2 hands repaired. So I need to get a bit fitter so I can get the other knee replaced, because that is knackered.
And so do you live with quite a lot of pain still?
Yeah, yeah. There's not much you can
do.
I
know, it's a weird thing, pain, because I have quite a bit of pain. And, like, what do you do to, like, help yourself deal with it, really? Because you've got such a positive attitude towards it.
Well, I keep busy. I keep knitting and crocheting. And I'm not sure whether that's actually caused the arthritis in my hands.
Yeah.
But I think if I stopped now, things would just get worse because I'd seize up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could lose weight and it'd be a lot better on my knees if I did. But it is also quite tricky to lose weight when you're in pain all the time.
Yeah, and can't exercise because that hurts.
Yeah, the physio said to me, oh, you just need to lose about 0.5 stone to get that other knee replaced. And I said, okay, I'll take up jogging. I've also got very, very elderly parents. And that's another thing since I've been back. My relationship with them has changed. I used to just be a once a week phone call, make sure they're alive. And now I'm over there practically daily.
Okay.
Because mum's got Parkinson's and dad's got a leaky aortic valve and could drop dead at any minute. And so they need quite a lot of support.
Do you feel happy to be able to offer that?
I don't know about happy.
Yeah.
I feel like it's my duty. I still haven't quite forgiven them for the 10-year-old me having to leave Ellesmere Port.
And what about them kicking you out?
Well, that was all the same thing. You know, my behaviour from the age of 11 to 17 when they threw me out was really difficult for any parent to cope with, you know. But at the same time, they have to appreciate that they moved me from my happy place. And I was no trouble before then.
And have you had that conversation with them as a parent yourself? And
yeah.
How did that go?
Funnily enough, my dad said he never liked Chester either.
So You've built a relationship back with them then now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the only one. I've got two brothers. One's in Colwyn Bay, one's in London. So I'm the only one that's immediately here. So, you know, there's only me around to be able to go shopping with me dad or sit with mum while he goes to the hospital or whatever. But they are going off on a cruise this weekend with my older brother and his wife.
Nice.
They'll be on separate parts of the ship, but brother and his wife will be there in case there's an emergency, which there often is.
Yeah.
Mum can't stay on her feet. Recently, Dad passed out in the kitchen, cut his head open on the radiator. Mum, trying to mop his brow, tripped over him and broke her arm. So we had to bundle him up and take him to the hospital and spent 11 hours in A&E, you know.
So just thinking about, like, probably more so and now even when you were off grid and that, and you were different, did society as a whole accept you for that, or did you feel judged and treated differently?
People would judge me who didn't know me. So I joined the local choir, for example, which met in a village hall at the end of the lane where I lived. And I didn't tell people I was the woman from that field initially. You know, I just joined the choir and became part of the choir and became accepted by people and a lot of middle class people in this choir with massive big houses and hated travellers, you know, because it's very near Glastonbury Festival as well. You've got to bear that in mind. So once they discovered I was that woman from that field, because they'd already developed a relationship with me, they were okay.
Yeah.
There was one bloke at a butty van who said, "Oh, people like you." Ugh. And I'd say, what people like me? What, social workers? Liverpool fans? What do you mean by people like me? You know? And then he quickly realised that I wasn't a benefits grounder, which is what he meant by people like me. You know?
Yeah.
He found that it did actually pay me way, thank you very much.
But what a great response to someone that's actually discriminating against you. You've got the level of intelligence to be able to do that and the quick wit and whatever else that makes it great. How do you think people could have been kinder to you, though? The things that people could have done to make life easier?
I think I was very well supported. For example, do you remember The Beast from the East, a big storm a good few years ago now? The amount of people who contacted me to check on my welfare during that storm, you know, I was really gratified by that, really, you know. My door was frozen shut. When I eventually got the door open, it was an east-facing door. It was just a bank of snow right up where the door opened it up. Like, oh, punched me way out through the snow, trying to persuade the pigs to eat snow. Come on, because they're wanting water. There is no water. Everything's frozen. Have snow. You eat snow, it'll be water, you know. They're intelligent animals, but they couldn't get that. But no, I felt that people were really kind. There was a lady in my choir who was a lady something, you know, she was an aristocrat. And she'd asked me, did I want to go and stay in her house for the winter? Oh. And I said to her, that's really kind, but my my cabin's warmer than your whole house. She lived in this massive mansion and they only heated one room. Yeah. You could get hypothermia going to the toilet there. You know? But yeah, also when I had my knee replaced, again, a number of people offered me support then. Do you want to come and stay with me? I stayed on my field. I was fine.
So that's interesting, actually, because, like, you've received lots of acts of kindness.
I think so, yeah.
Even though you're living a very different lifestyle. What's the best act of kindness you can think of?
I said, people looking after me pigs when I went away and, you know, enabling me to go and do things, you know, and offering me, you know, checking on my welfare, ringing me up and saying, you know, it's really bad weather, I just wanted to make sure you were okay. You know, I got a lot of that from people in the community, people I'd worked with, people I'd met, people in the village, people from the choir, people from the Smallholders Association. Because I wore all these different hats, you know. I was the show coordinator for the Somerset Smallholders Association.
Oh, very grand.
So I organised us going to shows agricultural shows and country fairs and things with a view to signing up membership and explaining to people about what smallholding was about. But it also gave smallholders opportunity to sell their wares, yeah, you know, and I coordinate all that. And I love doing that.
Wow. So in terms of people being very kind to you, do you think that's because of who you are actually, and you're a kind person yourself? You clearly do a lot for others. Happy to have Simon the Pirate stay on your land, and then you're doing all this work as the coordinator, which I assume was voluntary. I can't imagine.
Yeah, it's voluntary.
It's the Smallholding Association. And would you say you're a kind person?
I think I probably am, but I think the other thing that I am is an open person, yeah, and I'm always willing to engage with people. I like to talk to people. I'm interested in people's lives, you know.
Yeah.
I find in the city that it seems to be a tendency to people to stay in their own little bunkers.
Would a way that society could be kinder, actually, is to just engage and connect more?
I think so. Connecting's a key thing. When I moved back to the city, my only connections were with my family. But now I'm in a choir, I'm here in a craft group, I'm here in another knitting group. You know, there's a lot going on, and that's because I go out and I talk to people and I find out.
But again, that's you being proactive, isn't it? It's about not sitting at home thinking, oh, wait a minute.
I don't know what it is, whether people are afraid to go out and explore the community. My older brother, for example, he can't retire because he doesn't know what to do with himself. Whereas I took early retirement and now can't understand how I ever found the time to work.
You seem a very self-confident person then. Do you think that has something to do with it, in that you will go and get what you want out of life, and why not?
I think so. I think I'm quite clear about what I need, and I'm not afraid to ask for help as well. That's another thing.
And do you ever have that self-doubt though, or are you just kind of, you know who you are now?
I think we all experience self-doubt, don't we? You know, we always, you know, wonder about taking on things. I wonder if I can do that. I wonder if I'd be any good at that, you know.
But it's never stopped you.
Well, you've got to have a go at things, haven't you? I didn't know I could keep pigs until I kept pigs.
When you've been through that. And that's, has that kind of shaped you into this really amazing, self-confident person, do you think? Because you literally went and had to learn how to feed pigs and look after them.
Well, yeah.
Like putting yourself out of your comfort zone.
I think it might be going right back to when I was a homeless teenager. Yeah. You've got to survive, haven't you?
Yeah.
Let's find ways to do things.
And what an exciting life you've led up until now. There's loads more to come.
There is. I think so. I hope so.
So in terms of kindness then, we always do a bit of a summary at the end to say, like, you know, what would you say? How can we encourage others to be kind? I think the big one for me is around connection and actually us making an effort to connect with people, all of us as a society, no matter what our difference is, yeah, but to almost seek out people who are different and try and connect rather than just going to the people that you'd normally naturally go to because it's easy.
Yeah, I don't hang around in gangs. I'll mix with anybody.
Yeah. And how wonderful and rich enriched your life is because of that.
It's important to just be able to connect with people, to approach people, to be able to open a conversation and be open and honest. That's, yeah, the other thing. One of the big differences about Somerset to here is that we Northerners are more willing to talk honestly to people. In Somerset, they talk about you, not to you.
Yeah. Right, okay.
Whereas here, us Northerners, we are much more open.
So I think the third thing there for me is that authentic you, being open and honest.
Yes.
Because that, if you are, I've certainly learned this, then people are more likely to be open and, yeah, honest with you.
I've no airs and graces.
Which I love.
I've no sides, yeah, as somebody said to me once, and I was like,
I am going to have to share this story. I've popped into the craft group. We're at the Old Chapel Cafe and popped into the craft group and you had your arm in a cast. And, you know, you have your stereotypes of what a craft group should be like. And I've popped in enough times to see everyone, you know, doing their own little bits of craft. And then I said, oh, how's the arm to you? It's not great. I can't roll my own joints.
I did.
Pardon?
To be honest, I managed to learn to roll a joint one-handed within about a week of the surgery, which was really good because I'd ready rolled a big pile before my surgery and then I got home and couldn't knit and they were gone in 2 days.
But it was a good 2 days.
I don't know, I can't remember. And so my daughter had offered to come round and roll for me. Right? But she'd only just given up smoking anything and everything. And I didn't think it was fair. Right? Because 2 years ago, I had surgery on this hand and I had to go and stay with her. And she'd also just given up and she had to roll for me. And before you knew, she's like, I'll come and have a smoke with you. Yeah, like, you know. So this, I didn't want to encourage her to smoke again. So I sat and spent an afternoon learning to roll a joint with one hand. And you can see from the action that I've got it.
That's brilliant. And I just think about my mum asking me to roll a joint for her. It's just a different planet. I think that's ace.
I don't drink, but I do smoke weed, but I'm an arthritic, so...
Does it help with the pain?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, really. It really does, yeah. I keep telling the NHS they ought to give me the CBD oil on prescription and then I wouldn't have to smoke it because I can't smoke as much as I'd want to because I've got COPD.
Anything else around kindness?
It's important to pass on that as well with young people. I've got 4 grandchildren in my life.
And what kind of stuff? How do you do that with your lot?
Well, I've got 2 of the boys. There's only 17 months between them and they spend their time at loggerheads.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly separating. And rather than just saying, stop that, I feel there's always time to explain why it's important to stop that and what we should do as an alternative. I think it helps them become better people if they've got chance to learn how to be kind. And also I've got dogs, you know, I've got a dog and it's important to encourage them with animals, I think, to understand that helping other creatures helps develop your own self, you know. So it's important, if you've got a dog, it's important to walk it and feed it and pick its poo up and stroke it and brush it and be kind to it, you know.
I'd never thought of that, but you're so right with the animal connection there. I feel like I could just go on, but I think that's been brilliant. So thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Curious Chats and Kind Acts. It was lovely to have you. Can I just say a massive thank you to all the people that we've interviewed who have been so honest and vulnerable with me so that we can have these real life stories to share with you, our wonderful listener. And remember, we'd love to hear what random or small acts of kindness you've been up to so that we can maybe do a few. Find us on all the socials, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, and all our /ACTSGB, that's ACTSGB. And drop a comment on our feed, tweet us, or even send a photo. Let's build our kindness community together. We'll read some of our favourites on future episodes of Curious Chats and Kind Acts. And you never know, we might even have a go at a few of your ideas ourselves. Watch this space on the socials. For more information about the ACTS charity, including how to donate to us, head to actsonline.uk. See you next time!